Your Health is supported by the North Carolina Cancer Hospital, serving you with innovative research and unequaled care. UNC Healthcare is leading, teaching, caring.
Your Health with Dr. Adam Goldstein and Dr. Christy Page, presented by 97.9 The Hill and UNC Family Medicine. Your Health, providing practical health-related news and information for our community. As Drs. Page and Goldstein specialize in patient care at UNC Family Medicine. And now, Your Health on 97.9 The Hill and on demand at chapelboro.com.
Welcome to UNC Family Medicine's Your Health, supported by UNC Healthcare. I'm Dr. Adam Goldstein. I want to welcome back Dr. Stephen Hooper as our guest co-host. Welcome, Stephen.
Great to be here as always.
You know, it's great to have you. And we're fortunate to have on our show today Dr. Sarah Ruff, a family physician in Chapel Hill, North Carolina, who is a teacher, who is a practicing physician, who is a mother, who is a sports enthusiast, to talk about life behind the stethoscope, her experience as a family physician. I think it'd be really interesting. First, though, we've got some research that matters. And the very first one is about preterm newborns and what happens when they get into the neonatal intensive care unit. And should we do something to help improve how they sleep in that unit? Something that perhaps maybe doctors don't think quite as much about as we should.
Yeah, sleep at this point in time and most times and across our lifespan is very important, but very, very important for the very young and particularly those who are born preterm.
About 10% of U.S. newborns may require treatment in a neonatal intensive care unit, and it's exceedingly noisy. I did a little bit of training in one of these units, and there's lots of bells and whistles, not necessarily the good kinds of bells and whistles, all going off and a ding, 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 and all the heart rates being monitored. And, you know, we should recognize these kids need their sleep, perhaps even more. And environmental noise can be very detrimental. I think it was a really interesting research study that looked at what happens in this neonatal intensive care unit if you take 20 neonates and those also preterm, and you give them their mother's voice, reading them a book or talking to them. Does that help improve some of their neurocognitive or at least sleep?
Yes. And in fact, we know even prenatally, the fact of the matter is a parent's voice can be very important in the process of them recognizing who you are once they are delivered. And at this point, they do have some recognition of their parent's voice, particularly their mom's.
And they said that this might show their preliminary data that this intervention, as simple as recording the voice of the mother reading stories, may improve sleep. I don't think it worsens sleep. And I love when we were talking about before the show began, your experience watching what sometimes happens in that neonatal intensive care unit. You said that sometimes you see what happened.
Well, in addition to the noises and the buzzes that you have, a lot of times when I was there and we did rounds, a number of folks in the rounds, particularly the younger students, would put their clipboards and books on top of the bassinets, and they needed to be corrected, as that is truly the bed for that preterm infant. And so we don't want to exacerbate the environment any more than it is.
Yeah, I wonder the impact of having like 6, 8, 10 people huddling around that bassinet as well. It's like being in a room of a patient and knowing that the boundaries and the barriers and the exposure is very raw. Let's go into our next research that matters. And I think this is kind of a raw experience, which is pain that children can experience. And is there a way of reducing the pain they experience by your words?
It's very interesting because, as one of the doctors says in this study, prepping children for inoculations ahead of time doesn't work.
Right. We're going to give you a shot day and
it's going to hurt.
You know, it's going to hurt. Well, actually, telling people it's going to hurt may actually make it worse. What they're suggesting
That's
here,
correct.
And this was from UC Riverside, is how the expectations can influence pain. And so they are suggesting, based upon some research they did with 21 healthy children, 27 children with anxiety, and 25 adults, is that if you actually say this will be fine, this will not hurt that much, that people actually could experience less pain. That doesn't mean they won't still experience pain, but it might be less than saying, oh, this will hurt.
The other interesting facet of that was the 27 children with anxiety disorder, you know, where they're already coming in thinking perhaps the worst. And in fact, when they're prepped the way you just mentioned, in fact, they didn't experience the pain any differently than the typical children or the adults.
Yeah, this was in the journal Psychosomatic Medicine. And it reminds me of when I'm sometimes doing a knee injection, Steve, not something that a lot of people want, but sometimes is really helpful. People sometimes say, oh, I don't want that. That hurts so much. And I say, actually, in my experience, it hasn't hurt very much my patients. If it hurts, that means maybe we're doing something wrong. In that experience, most patients actually don't experience a lot of pain. Matter of fact, they experience some relief of pain. So sometimes I think telling people and reassuring people that you can do things that maybe are necessary and may lead to less pain. Well, let's move right along into our next research that matters. And this is a research published in Psychological Science about ways of increasing life satisfaction as we get older and strategies that may be better than others. What are they talking about?
One of the interesting facets of this study is that being tied into a social network of some kind, family, friends, other acquaintances, clubs, community, actually contributes to your feeling like you have better life satisfaction than if you choose activities that are non-social in nature.
Yeah, this was almost 1,200 participants, adults. And, you know, what were they going to do over the next year that might increase life satisfaction? And some said, there's not much I could change. And a bunch said, there is a specific strategy. And those folks did about the same over the next year in terms of life satisfaction. But of those who had a strategy, those who actually did something with other people.
Social.
Just as you say, service or being with other people actually had greater life satisfaction.
It did. They reported it and they were more engaged, quite frankly.
I don't know if this is cause and effect, because it could be that these people who were able to pick a item and were more likely then to ultimately be more satisfied. This is not a randomized controlled trial, but I don't think there's a downside here, right?
Well, it doesn't cost anything, a little social capital, so to speak. One of the aspects of this study that I was curious about is actually, why was that the case? And they speculate on that, but I think more work needs to be done there.
Right. I think there's, again, no downside. Talk about our last research that matters. And this is a group of people who have suffered traumatic brain injury, which happens a lot for lots of different reasons, whether it's an auto accident, whether it's a sporting injury, whether it's a fall. And research in ways of perhaps decreasing the impact of long-term of this traumatic brain injury.
And in particular, they were focusing on depression to look at the depressive symptoms that many individuals incur after having a TBI. And the fact of the matter is the more active folks are, the better they performed. And in particular, they had a strategy-based training that they developed and used in this study called Strategic Memory Advanced Reasoning Training, or SMART program. And they got pretty good results on the depressive outcomes.
Yeah, this was a type of cognitive training. We oftentimes call it cognitive behavioral therapy. People can learn this with apps online. And they had almost 80 individuals 6 months after injury and then went through this essentially 12 1.5-hour sessions over 2 months. And those who went through this session, the depressed group, actually had significantly reduced depression. And these are really high-risk injuries. So I was really happy to see this type of response.
Yes, I think it's very encouraging because this type of intervention has been around for a while for a number of different conditions. We recently published a paper looking at variants of this for children with chronic kidney disease. A lot of evidence-based work needs to be done here. But I think one of the fascinating parts of the study, Adam, was that they actually found changes in the prefrontal cortex in terms of thickness over time, which means that you have a behavioral treatment actually changing brain structure and perhaps brain function.
Wow. That's impressive. Our thoughts can influence our anatomy.
Well, it's actually neuro rehabilitation in many ways, or neurotherapy.
Well, that'll conclude the Research That Matters portion of our show. We're going to take a short break, and when we return, we'll be talking with University of North Carolina's Dr. Sarah Ruff about life behind the stethoscope, her experiences as a family physician. You're listening to Your Health with Dr. Adam Goldstein and Dr. Stephen Hooper. We'll be right back. UNC Family Medicine's number 2 ranked national program is rapidly transforming healthcare through excellence in teaching, clinical care, and research. To participate in UNC Family Medicine's efforts to move innovative ideas into action, call 919-843-5112 or email yourhealth@unc.edu.
Your Health with Dr. Adam Goldstein and Dr. Christy Page, a presentation of 97.9 The Hill and UNC Family Medicine. And now, more of Your Health.
Welcome back to Your Health with Dr. Adam Goldstein and Dr. Stephen Hooper. Today on Conversation, Steve, we're talking with University of North Carolina physician, Dr. Sarah Ruff, about life behind the stethoscope, her experience as a family physician. Welcome, Dr. Ruff.
Thank you. I'm glad to be here.
Yes, nice to have one of our own.
That's right. Always proud to be a Tar Heel.
You know, we were sitting down and just kind of talking as we sometimes do when you're precepting our residents in the UNC Family Medicine program, and I'm seeing patients, and we kind of chat about patients and just got to talking, and I thought it would be really fun to have you on to talk about kind of things that you do and are involved in, because it illustrates, I think, what is life like as a family physician? And maybe we could start out by you telling us a little bit about yourself. How did you get interested in healthcare and medicine and family medicine?
Yeah, I don't remember a moment where I said I'm definitely going to be a doctor. I always was interested in helping people. I thought I wanted to be a teacher for a while when I was little. I wanted to be a babysitter, and I was. I loved to hold little babies. I thought I wanted to be a nurse in the NICU and hold those little babies. And as my school progressed and I realized I really liked learning and liked studying, it just kind of felt like a natural progression into I want to go to medical school. I want to be a doctor. And I didn't know what family medicine was until I started in medical school. And most of my mentors, it was at Michigan State, the College of Human Medicine, and most of my mentors were family doctors, and I really loved seeing what they did. It was such a variety of different things that they did and different people that they saw, and I pretty much knew right away that I wanted to do family medicine, and I just loved it more and more as I learned more about that. So that's how I got interested in it.
You certainly married the helping profession with family medicine, didn't you?
Definitely. Yeah. And good thing I like learning, because our job is never done. We have to learn all the time.
What do you find as one of the most rewarding and one of the most challenging things? Maybe thinking back to a type of experience, a type of patient, or things within the healthcare system.
My favorite part about being a family doctor in the setting that I'm in now is being able to care for the entire family. So I take care of grandmothers, their daughters who are the mothers of then the children, and have sometimes delivered those mothers' babies. And I just really enjoy taking care of the whole family. And then the husband will come in, the dad, and it's really a blessing. And also being able to teach the residents, I've been really privileged to be able to deliver a lot of the residents' babies. And some of my colleagues have entrusted me with their care. And that is one of my favorite things. Just to, I feel a lot of just privilege, and that it's such a blessing that I actually get that opportunity to care for my colleagues and in their pregnancies and their babies and their hard times and their good times. So that's my favorite thing.
Do you have any particular area of family medicine that you have an affinity for that you really, really, really like? Sounds like the babies.
Definitely pregnancy, women's health, and pediatrics, babies. But I have a lovely older woman who's in her 80s, and she always jokes with me that she's the oldest patient that I have, and she's not, but she says, I know you're really bored with me. You love all the young ones. And I laugh and say, no, I love her too. She's great. She teaches me a lot, but I definitely tend to gravitate more toward the young moms and the babies. And I think that's also because that's kind of the stage that I've most recently come from.
I see. So you have a family and are attending to their needs as well.
Yes. I am married and I have two kids. Jackson is 10 and Savannah is 7.
The aspect of delivering babies as a family physician, in today's age, for a lot of listeners out there, that may seem unusual. Maybe they've never heard of family physicians delivering babies, but yet it's a vital part of the training of a family physician. And a lot of the care of rural populations, the maternal care, it may be disproportionately at times done by family physicians delivering babies, but it's not easy.
No, it's not easy. It's hard. It was always one of my favorite parts, though. So when I was looking for residency, I was looking for a program like UNC that had a lot of experience with that. And when I tell people what I do, what's a family medicine doctor do, and I mentioned delivering babies, most people are really surprised, and they didn't even know that that was possible. And then I explain why it is possible and how fun it is and great. And but you're right. It's very regional is what I found. There are certain people from different parts of the country that that's normal, and then some places it's very rare to see that.
Dr. Ruff, in North Carolina, how long have you been with us in North Carolina?
About 10 years since I started residency.
And do you find yourself reaching out to the rural areas in North Carolina to do your work?
Not so much. I work at a practice that has some inner city population as well as not. It's a wide variety of different types of insurance and different ages, and but not so much rural.
And so when you come to the University of North Carolina and you're just doing your training to be a family physician, the program here at University of North Carolina has an emphasis on taking care of patients in underserved communities. How did that fit with your understanding of the need for your desire to be a family physician, how you saw our healthcare system? How did all that come together?
I was in the National Health Service Corps when I got started. So I knew that after residency, I was going to be working in an underserved population. And when I was finished with residency, at the time, there weren't any spaces in the state, whereas now I believe there are plenty. But at the time, I had to leave the state in order to fulfill my requirement. And I went back to Michigan, and I lived in Saginaw, Michigan for 4 years and worked in a federally qualified health center there. And it was a really good experience. It wasn't so much rural. It was more inner city, but it was definitely underserved. And I learned a lot there. And I was really glad I had that opportunity before I came back in between residency and working here now, because I don't know that I would have had that experience if I just stayed.
What did you learn?
Well, I learned that it's not very easy to take care of patients if they don't have resources. And a lot of patients that I just wanted to order a stress test, and I couldn't just order a stress test like I could in residency, where I had specialists available all the time. And so that was just really different. I had to really think about things. I had to try to work the system, and we relied a lot on, there was a local health plan that was only available to the uninsured people in the city that I learned a lot about. So I learned it was really hard when patients don't have resources.
You started down the path of challenges, and I'm curious what other challenges you have as a family physician working in North Carolina and underserved areas.
Challenges always, I want to help patients as much as I can, but you can only help people so much because it's a team effort and patients need to help themselves. So I would say now some of my challenges involve really wanting to help patients make changes, but it's a little challenging sometimes if they're not on board.
We're going to take a break in a minute, but one of the things I always see you doing is really being really positive about when you're interacting with learners and talking with them about care, practical and positive. You don't necessarily have them do things that you don't think will help patients, but you seem to bring this positive energy. In today's medical marketplace, where sometimes it can be frustrating, how do you bring that positive energy into interactions with all sorts of people?
I try to be as positive as I can because that really helps me to get through my day. And I realize that I can only affect myself. I can't change a lot of things. So I try to focus on the things that I can change and work towards those. So whereas I see some of my colleagues getting frustrated with the administration or all the check boxes that we have to check as family physicians, I just can't get bogged down by that because I can't really change it. So I try to focus on the things that I can change and that helps me be positive.
What a wonderful lesson. We're going to make sure that all of our medical students and residents hear this message, and even my colleagues as well, because I think accepting the things that can't change and changing the things you can is certainly a key to success. We're going to take a short break, but when we return, we're going to continue our conversations with Dr. Sarah Ruff, family physician at the University of North Carolina, in practice, and a teacher, and a mother, and much more. We'll be right back with your health. Stay with us.
Your health is supported by UNC Health Sciences Library and NC Health Info, working together to connect people everywhere with knowledge to improve health. Visit nchealthinfo.org for answers you can trust.
Your Health with Dr. Adam Goldstein and Dr. Christy Page, a presentation of 97.9 The Hill and UNC Family Medicine. And now, more of Your Health.
Welcome back. You're listening to Your Health, and we're talking with UNC's Dr. Sarah Ruff about life behind a stethoscope, her experiences as a family physician. And we've been talking in the last segment about sort of the things you like and some challenges in what you do. And we noticed that in some of the information about you, you have, I love international population medicine. Tell us a little bit about that.
Well, when I was in undergrad, I knew I wanted to go to medical school, and I thought everybody had to major in biology, but that seemed kind of boring to me. So then I found out you could major in anything you wanted. So I chose to major in Spanish, and I learned how to speak Spanish pretty fluently at the time and traveled to different countries in my college time. And then afterwards in medical school, I went on a bunch of missionary trips. And I have continued to use my Spanish just on a day-to-day seeing patients, and it's been really fun.
It's actually probably essential in the work and the populations that you see, and what a gift to bring to the UNC system.
It really is nice, and patients just, you can see them really relax when they realize that they don't have to, they can understand and I can understand them. It's really great.
And you were seeing patients earlier today that you said you had, that skill was one you had to use.
That's right.
What in general was happening?
Today, it was just a physical exam of a woman whose primary language was Spanish, and she did speak English, and we probably could have done the visit in English if I didn't speak Spanish, but she felt much more comfortable. And for a physical exam, for her, I wanted her to feel the most comfortable, and she was very gracious. If I didn't know words, she would help me out, and vice versa.
It's like she was working with you.
She was.
Which is exactly what you want, right?
Yep, exactly.
You know, one of the things that I so admire about you is that not only are you positive and practical, you bring life skills that are ones that perhaps I didn't necessarily have as much experience. You are a mother, which obviously I'm a father, but how did having children change your experiences both as a family physician and as a person?
It really helped, I think, take care of families once I had my own family. I realized that a lot of the advice that I was giving to parents, I had learned, but I couldn't really relate to it. And once I could relate with a lot of the challenges of having new babies and breastfeeding and being a working mother and all of those things and balancing family, I felt like I was much more equipped to offer some advice to parents that I take care of. And I feel like it's made me more relatable. And breastfeeding moms are another one of my favorite populations to talk to and to help. And I'm really thankful that I've had that experience myself so that I can really understand kind of what they're going through.
You have a child that has some special needs, and that gives you some really broad insights into probably what is more the norm than not are children and families with special needs.
Yeah, and that's a really difficult area to navigate as a parent when you know that something is just not right and you want to get your child the right help, but it's really hard to know where to go. And having had to navigate that myself, I am very thankful with that because I can help parents kind of know the steps to take when they just know something's not quite right. They need something, but they don't know exactly what. And I might not have the answers, but at least I can kind of help them take the first steps.
Even as a family physician, you're navigating things sometimes for the first time yourself.
Yeah, absolutely. It's really a challenge out there. It makes me really thankful that I have a lot of resources and people to ask, because if I didn't, I don't know what I would do. It's really difficult to know even who to ask in that situation. So it's been a real learning experience for me. And in my practice, a bunch of us have had to go through this with family members and with each other. And so we all can share that experience with each other. And when patients come our way, we're much better equipped to offer them advice and where to go.
Mm-hmm. Makes you a better physician and caregiver.
Yeah, I'm always really thankful for those hard experiences. You said what makes you so positive. And one of the other things is I know that it's going to make me take care of patients better. If I can go through something, then it really does help. It gives me credibility. It gives me information that I can help others. So those things, like having a child with special needs and being a mom, those things I'm really thankful for. It helps.
Tell us a little bit about teaching. One of the things that I think distinguishes some family physicians, particularly those that are interested in helping the next generation, is a commitment to teaching. What would you say is your teaching style, and where did it come from?
My teaching style is kind of laid back, and I try to just be real. And I like to not only teach information, but I like to teach where to find information if I don't know all the answers. I wouldn't say I'm a walking encyclopedia, but I definitely know where to look because that's what I do on a daily basis. So I think when residents and new physicians are out in the real world, they might not know all the answers, but they need to know where to find the answers. So I definitely can teach them that. And I also like them to, I like to talk to residents and learners about what it's like to be a doctor now, and so that they can be encouraged and see what it's like. Because sometimes when you're in the midst of residency or medical school, it's really difficult to see kind of out of that box, and just to know kind of that people can be happy and have fulfilling lives. It's not always so sleep depriving as it is when they're in that moment now. So I try to relate to them on more levels than just teaching them about that fact at the moment.
One of the things I was curious about was related to the teaching and your patient care. You note, I think of health as encompassing not only physical aspects, but also spiritual and emotional. How do you bring that into your teaching and your clinical care?
Well, with my teaching, I would say just more asking questions of the either residents or medical students when they're asking me, just to find out more information, because a lot of times it's those other aspects of the patient's lives, their what's going on with them emotionally or in relationships, that really affects their health. And so getting students to think about those things can help them, because you can't just prescribe a medicine if the patient's not going to take the medicine because they don't have enough money and those kind of things. There's just so many layers. And then in my clinical care, it's more of just realizing that there's so much depression and anxiety nowadays, and it affects everything, affects every encounter that I have, even if the patient doesn't seem to be coming in for that. Even stress, even if it's not clinical diagnosis, but just stress and life in general is just really getting to people. And so just allowing them to talk about that and seeing if it is something that needs medication or therapy. We started having a therapist in our office now, and that's been one of the biggest things, just for all of my patients to know that if you say, oh, you should go get a counselor, and that's just such a big statement. There's so many choices. But knowing that there's somebody down the hall that they can at least talk to for a few sessions is really helpful and not so scary.
What would you say is the next chapter, say, 5 years from now? Where is Dr. Sarah Ruff? What's she doing? What's she passionate about?
I think this year is the thing that I've added is teaching medical students more, whereas before I was teaching residents already. I'd like to continue with all of that. I hope to be still delivering babies and being passionate about that. I really would love to dive more into breastfeeding. One of my passions is trying to be a certified lactation consultant. I think that would bring a lot to my practice. It's just finding that time. So one of these days, I hope to really be able to take time away to do that and get that certification.
Helping mothers who are delivering breastfeed.
That's right. And or in just in the community, the access to certified lactation consultants is sometimes challenging. So I'd love to offer that to my patients.
And what are your final thoughts about you would advise to listeners about family medicine?
I think family medicine is such a great specialty. I think more patients are going to gravitate towards it. I think it's going to grow as patients realize that they want a more integrative approach and they want somebody who can take care of their whole family and take everything into account. And I think that that's something that we can offer uniquely, and I think it's going to become more popular.
Well, I think we need to thank you, Sarah Ruff, family physician in the University of North Carolina system, for being willing to come talk with us and about family medicine, a little bit about your passion and your family, and sharing some of that positive, practical advice for our listeners.
Thank you so much for having me.
Thank you so much. We're going to take a short break, and when we come back, we'll be answering questions about your health. You're listening to Your Health with Dr. Adam Goldstein and Dr. Stephen Hooper. We'll be right back.
Your Health with Dr. Adam Goldstein and Dr. Christy Page, a presentation of 97.9 The Hill and UNC Family Medicine. And now, more of Your Health.
Welcome back to Your Health. For the house call segment of our show today, we're going to spend a few minutes talking about your health questions and concerns. And if a listener has a question they'd like us to address on an upcoming show, they can send their comments to yourhealth@unc.edu. And we're really excited because Dr. Sarah Ruff has actually agreed to join us for house calls. We get to really get to test your knowledge here.
Awesome.
A little bit.
I'm excited.
And we'll get your enthusiasm. We'll see what she says first, Steve, and then we'll see whether or not we...
the bar has been set
the
high.
The bar has been set high. We'd like to ask our executive producer, Laura Lacey, to read us our very first house call question today. Laura?
I recently saw that UNC has a virtual urgent care service that patients can use 24/7. When would you recommend a patient consider that, and what's the process?
I think we're talking about here like telephone medicine, perhaps with someone who's trained in urgent care, perhaps emergency room providers. Do you think that's what we're talking about here?
That sounds reasonable.
We're not just talking about going to an urgent care, which
correct.
We're talking about
either a video chat or a phone call, possibly.
Yeah. And I believe you have to actually get an account and sign in when you have your question. So it's protected and it's safe to share your concerns.
And there's increasingly a lot of services that offer this for healthcare systems, employee benefits. They're trying to drive down the utilization of expensive emergency room care that can be the thousands or tens of thousands of dollars, and believe that a lot of these simple things that people might come in can be answered. And what do you think about that?
I think in certain situations, it could be good for the patient. Sometimes they just need a reassurance that they can wait till the morning and they're worried that they might not be able to. And if it's something simple like looking at a rash on a video chat, that might be an easy thing to do. If the doctor, the virtual doctor, can save them by saying, yes, you do need to go to the emergency room, then that would also be helpful. So I think in some situations that would be good.
Yeah, the only thing I'd be concerned about is there an incentive to not have the patient go to the emergency room? They always know what the incentive is. And increasingly, if you're doing expensive care in the emergency room, but the hospital's getting reimbursed for that, maybe the incentive is to go to the emergency room and have more care. If the incentive is not to go to the emergency room because the provider gets paid more. So I think knowing those incentives, hopefully none of us do things for the wrong reasons, but hopefully this is good medicine done for the right reasons. What's our very next house call, Laura?
My father passed away about 6 months ago, and my mother's still having a really hard time with the loss. I'd like to get a little more involved with her medical care just to make sure that she's both able to handle her health during her grief, but also to be in contact with her physician should her grief and depression worsen. How do you recommend I go about doing that?
Well, we probably have a couple different answers for that. I know that having cared for my mother and the recognition that I needed to become more involved, I simply said, Mom, I'd like to become a little bit more involved. I think it would be to your health. Are you okay? So I did ask for permission.
Yeah, I think that's really great strategy. I usually tell, for instance, the mother in this situation, if I was seeing the mother usually knows that her children are worried about her and her mental health. She may say that. And so as a physician, I can encourage her to bring them along next time if they want to talk about it. But I think your approach to just being honest with your mom and saying, hey, can I come? That would probably be the best idea.
Agreed. I think talking with her may be very hard because it starts to get into role reversal, where the child now becomes the parent in many ways. But the fact of the matter is like having that discussion. My experience has been that if it's not the right time, your parent will tell you.
I will have children of parents call me at times, send me emails. I don't know how they get my number, but everyone seems to have it, about this worry. And they'll want to know what I should do. So I'll say, well, if you come here with your mother, I have a better place that I can talk about things. It's harder for me to talk about it with you right now because you're not my patient. I don't have permission to talk with you. But thank you for your concern. Try to show up the next time.
Yeah, exactly. Or I usually tell them just to tell their loved one how they feel. And when that loved one comes in, I usually ask, how's your family think that you're doing with this? They usually really know. And they say, they think I should be doing X, Y, Z, and I think I'm doing just fine. And so it's a good opportunity just to kind of see their perspective as well.
Or they'll probably say, you know, because I know she's spoken with you already.
That's right. So bring her in.
There are no secrets in a family physician's
office.
It's
hard, yeah.
Closing those loops, though, is very important.
It is.
Laura, what's our very next house call?
My 2-year-old is an incredibly picky eater. Do you have any advice for making sure she gets the nutrients she needs? Sometimes it seems like it's just a battle of wills.
Think about, is that your 2-year-old a picky eater, or are they just being obstinate because they're learning to say no? And I think that's an important distinction. And there's a number of strategies here. And I think sometimes talking to your pediatrician or your primary care provider about this very common question is very helpful. But in some ways, it's no different than when you get into a battle with wearing, you know, the green shirt versus the yellow shirt. You lay it out and you let them make a choice. And I think as long as nutritionally you're giving them good choices, they'll choose something. And again, you can assure that it's a nutritious choice. If it's really a situation where things are problematic, you may want to visit again with your primary care provider and talk about consult with a nutritionist just to kind of get an idea of, is your child getting what he or she needs?
I usually first reassure that it's probably just a phase and that with toddlers, they're just so on the move that it's really hard just to sit and eat. And so to think about it as what are they eating in the whole week instead of just what are they eating that day. And then also just reinforcing that, you know, everything on the plate is something that you want them to eat. So if you don't want them to eat it, don't offer it. But always have at least one familiar food there that you know that they'll go to. And also to maybe allow them to eat on the move so that they don't have to sit still for so long at that phase. I've also made recommendations for occupational therapy to help with eating if that seems to be more of the issue.
Some of that would be good advice for maybe doctors.
That's right.
Laura, what's our very last house call?
Our son had a lot of trouble in first grade last year, both with his behavior and with his grades. At what point should we begin to wonder if he might have a learning disability or perhaps ADD? How should we go about exploring that?
I would, again, have that conversation with your primary care provider to begin the conversation. As a pediatric neuropsychologist, I actually am in favor of not waiting. If you have concerns, they should be checked out with formal assessment. And sometimes those assessments are done at no charge in a public school system. You can also secure those types of assessments privately. But those assessments should go directly at underlying learning needs, attention, and perhaps other issues that may have contributed to your son struggling in first grade. It may not be either a learning disability or ADHD, but there could be other factors at play.
Agreed. For instance, diet and sleep are really important at that age, so questioning parents about that. But I also agree as early as possible to get on waiting lists for testing. So the public schools are great, but there's always a waiting list. And so just get on those waiting lists. And if they have the means to have some private testing, that's also really good.
Yeah. And I finally would say, if something doesn't seem right to you as a parent, it probably isn't.
Absolutely.
Trust your instincts because you're the expert in your child's health. The doctor may be an expert in children's health, but you're the expert in your child's health. So don't take no for an answer if you feel like there's something else that you need to do.
Absolutely.
Wait and see should not be an option.
Agreed.
Well, that'll conclude our house calls today. And we want to thank all our listeners for joining us today for your health. We hope we've addressed issues and concerns that are important to you. You can share any question or story by emailing us at yourhealth@unc.edu or visit us online at yourhealthradio.org or follow us on Twitter, Facebook, or iTunes. We'd like to thank the UNC Department of Family Medicine, UNC Healthcare for their sponsorship. I want to thank our guest co-host, Dr. Stephen Hooper, and our guest today, Dr. Sarah Ruff. We hope you join us next time on Your Health. On behalf of Your Health, we'll look forward to talking with you again next week. Take care.
The purpose of Your Health Radio is to educate listeners on healthcare issues. Listeners should always discuss their own health or medical concerns with their personal physician or other healthcare provider. Your Health is not a substitute for medical advice, diagnosis, or treatment.
You've been listening to Your Health with Dr. Adam Goldstein and Dr. Christy Page on 97.9 The Hill, presented by UNC Family Medicine. You can find this or any other episode of Your Health on demand at chapelboro.com. Your Health with Dr. Adam Goldstein and Dr. Christy Page on 97.9 The Hill, your community radio station.